Hello and welcome to another Nerding Out with That Nerdy Catholic. I'm Seth Payne. Cesar and I are still on our break, but we have another unreleased episode to share with you. A few years ago, I was able to sit down with Holly Ordway and talk to her about Tolkien and the role that his faith played in his literature, especially in The Lord of the Rings and in The Hobbit. Holly Ordway's latest book is called Tolkien's Faith, A Spiritual Biography. A link to purchase it will be in the description below. I started reading it last week, and I'm a couple of chapters in, and so far it is a really interesting book, looking at Tolkien's faith, where it comes from. You know, I'm learning right now about the faith of his parents, especially his mother, in raising him. And so I highly encourage you to check that book out. But Holly has written a number of books on Tolkien, and so that is the focus of our conversation today. And I hope you enjoy it. Well, welcome to another Nerding Out with That Nerdy Catholic. I'm Seth Payne, That Nerdy Catholic, and today we have a special guest on with us. Dr. Holly Ordway is the Cardinal Francis George Fellow of Faith and Culture at the Word on Fire Institute. If you know much about the Catholic culture on YouTube, you know Word on Fire. Bishop Barron has been active on YouTube for a number of years, and the Word on Fire Institute is really doing a lot of great things to spread the Catholic faith online. But especially, I really think there's a number of intersections to what we're trying to do here in really looking at the intelligibility of faith. And so, and we're going to be talking to Holly Ordway today about Tolkien. And I think there's a lot of really interesting crossovers between faith and science and being intelligent about that's what we're going to be going into today. Holly Ordway is also the visiting professor of apologetics at the Houston Baptist University. And you can find more out about her at hollyordway.com. So, Dr. Ordway, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, so the reason I had you on is your focus is mainly Tolkien, but you teach in literature. And so I wanted to start off this conversation talking about how you got into literature in general, but also specifically Tolkien.
Well, it's almost not a question of how did I get into it, but more have I always been in it, because I have been an avid reader ever since I was a little kid, learned to read very early and just immersed myself in reading. Mm-hmm. And Tolkien's books were among some of the ones that I first fell in love with. In fact, I can't even remember the first time that I read The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. I can only remember rereading them. So I counted mm-hmm. those pretty early on. Narnia Chronicles, lots of fantasy, science fiction, folk tales, lots of things like that. And, was just a really avid reader, studied literature in college. And, you know, so the literature part was always a big part of my life, and mm-hmm. Tolkien as well. And it's interesting because Tolkien has been really influential in my life in lots of ways. You know, as I said, I read his Hobbit and Lord of the Rings when I was a girl, and that picture of the beautiful, meaningful quality of Middle Earth, where, you know, where good and evil are things that matter, are things that ended up being influential for me in becoming a Christian. That's one part of my story. But also, I really can owe it to Tolkien that I became a literary critic, because his great essay on fairy stories is an example of the kind of literary criticism that I think we need, that is fundamentally appreciative, that helps you, you know, gain more from what you're reading, not just pull it apart to dissect it. And I encountered that as a teenager, and just blew me away. And so really, in a sense, I can trace so much in my life to the influence of Tolkien on me as a young woman.
And so as you're growing and you continue to read Tolkien, talk about how you're talking about your developing understanding about his worldview and how that was kind of how that's incorporated into all of his writings.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, he's a devout Catholic, but a lot of people don't really know that, or they mm-hmm. kind of know it, but they sort of tend to compartmentalize it and think, oh yeah, well, he was a Catholic, but because there's mm-hmm. no overt religion in his works of Middle Earth. And he does that deliberately. He says that he's chosen not to put that into, you know, his works in an overt way, because it's instead in the story, it's in the symbolism.
Yeah.
And I think this is one of the things that makes Tolkien really interesting to look at from the standpoint of evangelization, because his books are so attractive. It's just great stories that they draw in loads of people who are not religious at all, let alone Catholic, mm-hmm. such as myself as a younger person. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know, until much later when I began studying Tolkien seriously, doing my doctoral dissertation on fantasy, that I really came to grips with, yeah, he's a Christian. I mean, I sort of knew that vaguely, mm-hmm. but was able to kind of push it aside and really realizing, yeah, he's one of those Christian people. How weird is that? Mm-hmm. So I think it's interesting to note, you know, that question of how do we look at his faith in his works? And as it happens, this is the subject of my next book. I'm working on a book right now, writing it on his Christian faith, because it's a subject that's harder than people realize to deal with. Because on the one hand, like I said, you can just sort of compartmentalize him and say, oh, well, I don't need to think about his faith because Middle Earth is, you know, not overtly religious. And yet he himself is very clear that no, the God of Middle Earth is God. mm-hmm. And that his mythological realities are actually in line with his own theology. This is what he believes mm-hmm. to be true. And his faith is really embedded and implicit in his work, and deliberately so. But on the flip side, you do also get people who do see that he's a Christian and want to make much of it, and then end up kind of forcing an almost allegorical, you know, reading on his books, you know, the gospel and mm-hmm. Middle Earth and that sort of thing. If there's a book by that title, I wasn't referring to it particularly. Just like this whole idea of, you know, can we sort of read it allegorically as the Christian story? And the answer, of course, is no. It's not an allegory. It's much more sophisticated, yeah. you know. But you get, oddly enough, these two extremes: the people who make everything about his work just about a kind of in-your-face Catholicism. No. But also the people who want to say, oh, it doesn't matter at all. No. It's really someplace more interesting in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah. And Tolkien was in the Inklings with Lewis. And Lewis has a much more direct allegorical style in his writings. You know, you can read Narnia, you can see Jesus in Aslan, and it's very direct.
Just I must nerd out here. This is the nerdy Catholic, so I must nerd out. It's not even that is not allegory, because allegory is a consistent pattern through the whole work. And Lewis is very clear, it's not an allegory, it's a supposal. Okay. What if Aslan were Christ in the other world?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that correction. But you do see a much more direct connection between Aslan and Christ. When I read The Lord of the Rings, it feels more along the lines of, you know, seeing Christ in the characters of The Lord of the Rings feels more like seeing Christ in anyone. You know, if you look at anyone's life, you can see how they live, and you can see Christ in them. So as you said, it's not, there's no one-to-one connection between any character in The Lord of the Rings and Christ. But talk about some of the characters in The Lord of the Rings and how you see Christ in them.
Well, I think you're quite right. You know, because in the Narnia Chronicles, Lewis gives us explicitly, you know, Christ is a character. Aslan mm-hmm. is the character. And there is no Christ figure in The Lord of the Rings in that way. And so we do mm-hmm. see these sort of, you know, images of Christ. And one of the things I think is really interesting about the way that Tolkien does it is that we do see, you know, individual people being Christ-like, but we also see it in, representing sort of different aspects of Christ. So for instance, we see, Gandalf has a Christ-like story arc because he literally, goes down into darkness and death to mm-hmm. save the fellowship and then mm-hmm. rises. And we have, Gandalf the White, who is subtly different than he was before. He's not quite the same. He's Gandalf and yet. So mm-hmm. that's a sort of resurrected Christ image. And then Aragorn is a figure really of Christ the King, because we have the hidden, the despised king who has to come and come back to his rightful throne, which has been held by Steward, and mm-hmm. he is the one who brings justice, and he is the one who brings healing. And that is again a Christ-like characteristic, the king who is also the healer. So in mm-hmm. Aragorn, we see a Christ figure. And then, of course, in both Frodo and Sam, on that, especially in the long trek to Mordor, we really see Christ, the suffering servant, because they are, going through all this agony on this road, this road to the cross, in a sense, mm-hmm. Bearing the ring and getting all the way there and just giving their all and with mm-hmm. such suffering. And so it's really, again, a very Christ-like figure, and again, both Frodo and Sam, it's not just a one-to-one correspondence. And of course, mm-hmm. Frodo is the one who's carrying the ring, but then Sam is the one who at the end carries Frodo. So it's a very rich and nuanced image that we see.
One of the things I appreciate about seeing Tolkien's view of Christ, of Christianity and even Catholicism in The Lord of the Rings is that you see, for me, I get a very, very much deeper view of Christianity. And it's this view of, it can be very easy to look at Christianity, especially from the outside, and see it, well, They just believe in this guy that came and hung on a cross, and they say he loved him. It, you can have a very simplistic view of what Christianity is. But when I read The Lord of the Rings and a lot of other fantasy that has been written by many Christians, I see this reality that we are part of a much bigger story, that we are part of this great cosmos that is even bigger than kind of the cosmos that we see looking through a telescope, right?
So that is something we see in The Lord of the Rings, even that sense of being part of a meaningful narrative. I mean, I was just minded, just as you said that, of that marvelous meta-textual moment when Frodo and Sam, they're in the mountains, they're on the way to Mordor, and Sam is reflecting about how at some point, wouldn't it be nice if there were stories written about, their epic adventures, and would they be written in a big book, and then someone would be reading it and they'd be saying, oh, Mr. Frodo, tell us about Mr. Frodo. And so they're talking about their own stories being written in a book, being read by other people, which mm-hmm. of course is precisely what's happening. It's really a brilliantly postmodern move. And I think this is particularly worth noting. And this again is in the context of, the research I've done for my newest book, which is Tolkien's Modern Reading, about all the reading and the way that Tolkien really read contemporary literature, engaged with it, engaged with modernity, because you see mm-hmm. that he's using a quite sophisticated modern or even sort of postmodern literary technique to call our attention to really a fundamentally Catholic idea. We're all in this story, this narrative of salvation that God is the author, and we're part of it. And I think that's mm-hmm. such a fascinating way that he kind of draws us into it.
Yeah. And see if I can remember this correctly. I think there's a quote that is Gandalf. I think he's talking to, he's either Frodo or Sam talking about that the part that they're playing, they don't know. They don't really see the part that they're playing because they're in it, but they are playing a part in a much, much bigger story.
Yeah. And I think that really is part of how we need to be understanding what it means to be a Christian, because you're right. There's this sort of stereotype, simplistic idea, which even a lot of Christians have, that, mm-hmm. oh yeah, basically God kind of comes from outside and does this thing, and I can relate to him in this particular way, but it doesn't affect the rest of my life. No, actually, the entire cosmos is part of this. There is no inch of reality that is not encompassed within the Christian understanding, because it's a description of reality. Mm-hmm. And therefore, everything that we're doing, our whole story of our lives, is part of that grand story, whatever the end is going to be for us. And that's mm-hmm. where we start saying, oh, wait, this matters, right? And that, I think, makes our Christian faith much more, well, representative reality, and also much more engaging, because it is, honestly, it is kind of silly to think of, oh, so if Christianity is just some guy came and died 2,000 years ago and I say yes to that and then that's it, I'm done. That doesn't make, mm-hmm. you know, that doesn't make much sense. And I can see why, well, I didn't used to believe it had made sense. It's perfectly reasonable to say, yeah, that's kind of silly, because mm-hmm. it is silly. If you just take it out of context and say that it's not part of the whole story, but there is the whole story. And I think that's part of the attraction of Tolkien's works, because he himself was, you know, very devout and had a very integrated perspective. And so mm-hmm. he brings that integration, that wholeness into his fiction. So, you know, his stories are deeply Christian without being overtly so, which is kind of the opposite of a lot of sort of rubbishy Christian fiction that there is nowadays.
Yeah. And it has helped me understand reading The Lord of the Rings. It has helped me understand one aspect of this, the Catholic understanding of redemptive suffering. You know, and it makes me think of, you know, reading Job, the suffering that he went through, and when God told him, you know, basically, you know, you don't know why, but why are you asking me? I'm the author of all creation. And so we're reading about the suffering of Frodo and Sam, and in thinking of what they're going through, as if you were them, you would ask the same question: why am I going through all of this suffering? But we are outside of the story, and we're reading the story, we know, and we're even being told through the narrative why they have to go through all of this. And so as a Christian, going through suffering, even if it's hard at the time, especially if it's hard at the time, if we can always look and say, well, God has a plan for this. There's some story that I don't know the whole story because I'm just a part of it.
Yeah, it helps to produce that context to make sense of it. And I think, you know, making sense of things is not the same thing as making the suffering go away. Because mm-hmm. when your suffering is meaningful, it's still suffering, right? Exactly. And I think that, again, there's the sort of superficial idea of, oh, if you're a Christian, you're never going to suffer because it's all for the love of God. Well, it is all mm-hmm. for the love of God, but pain still hurts, right?
Yeah.
You know, St. Paul says, you know, to people who are grieving, don't grieve as the pagans do who have no hope. But he doesn't say don't grieve. He says mm-hmm. don't grieve as if it was, you know, hopeless. And I think mm-hmm. that's a really important nuance, because we're still going to grieve our losses. We're still going to suffer pain. And we see all of this, you know, in The Lord of the Rings, because, you know, Tolkien himself, I mean, he knew this firsthand. He lost both of his parents relatively young, fought in the front lines, you know, in the Great War, you know, had trench fever, suffered quite a lot from, you know, physical ailments throughout his life. You know, many of his good friends were killed in the war. You know, he was a man who was really acquainted with suffering. So when he mm-hmm. gives this vision of how things are meaningful, you know, he's not just sort of making it up. He's like, yeah, he's been there.
Yeah.
He's been through it. And that gives it, I think, a resonance that it wouldn't maybe otherwise have.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm so fascinated about Tolkien, and especially in The Lord of the Rings, is he didn't just write these books. He created whole languages. He created a whole history. And that's, I don't know many other authors. I personally can't think of any other authors that have gone that far in writing these stories to create so much history and so much culture and even the languages. Talk about that a little bit.
Tolkien, this is one of the places where we have to just say he is a genius. He is so far beyond the sort of the norm in this that we have to, I think, just sort of stand back in a kind of awe, astonished awe. Because of course there are authors who make up languages and histories. But Tolkien didn't just do that. He started with the languages, and his languages aren't just, you know, lists of vocabulary that somebody made up. I mean, he was a linguist. He was a philologist. So his languages actually work. You know, they follow the sound rules. They follow the rules of the development of languages over time. And so we have, you know, he's creating these various Elvish languages. He didn't just create Elvish. He's got all these various Elvish languages that develop and diverge as they would have historically. I mean, it's just astonishing. Mm-hmm. And of course, all the histories that he develops. And I think that in a way kind of gives us a clue to the power of his stories. Not just that they were linguistically based, although I do think that Tolkien's genius was such that this actually really created a lot of the depth of it, but that, you know, he didn't say to himself, I'm going to write a best-selling novel and I want it to have depth. I had better invent some languages. He invented the languages out of pure love of language. He just thought it was really fun and exciting. It was thrilling to him. It was satisfying. He would have made up the languages in any case. And because he had such a fertile and powerful creative imagination, he starts creating the stories that are bubbling up out as he's creating these languages. So in a sense, all of this is an example of how his writing comes out of love, because he was just taking such joy. He loved creating those languages. For him, it wasn't like a tedious chore. Oh, gotta invent Dwarvish. Okay, better buckle down to it. He was excited about it. And I think that love of what he was doing comes through implicitly. I think that fundamentally is why the languages are so important to Middle Earth, not just because of the way they contribute to the depth of it, but because his whole legendarium is just something, he just loved every inch of it. And I think that can't help but bring something vital to his work.
Yeah. So you teach Tolkien, right? In literature? Is that one of the subjects that you teach?
No, not really. Yeah, I actually have an interesting life because I work now for Word on Fire, the Word on Fire Institute. Mm-hmm. I'm visiting professor at Houston Baptist University. So I'm no longer doing full-time teaching. And in fact, when I did, I didn't actually teach Tolkien. I taught a lot of other literature, but at HBU, Tolkien's actually taught in a class, literature and apologetics, by my colleague Michael Ward, and he teaches Tolkien. So we kind of divvied up the different authors that we did. So I write about Tolkien, but I don't. In fact, I taught one class on him once, but I don't specifically teach on Tolkien. But now, as part of the Word on Fire Institute, I do a lot of internal, you know, video courses and seminars for our institute members. And of course I do a lot of lecturing and talks and conferences outside. So I do teach on Tolkien, but not as classes per se.
Okay. Well, then looking back at your own experience then about discovering Tolkien, and especially in discovering his faith, talk to someone who is out there who might be watching this, who is not sure if they should or what they should think about this whole Christianity thing, this whole faith thing, but loves Tolkien. How would you recommend exploring his writings and looking into his faith and finding his faith through his writing?
Well, that's a great question. And the first thing I would say is that this was really my path into the faith, because I was an atheist and totally rejected Christianity completely, thought it was complete nonsense, but had studied literature, had done my dissertation in fantasy, had centered this dissertation on Tolkien, and having to come to grips with the fact that Tolkien really is Christian. I love his work and wanted to reject everything he believed. And so, a few years later, I began really just to be thinking about that again and realizing, if I love his work and reject everything that he believes as being stupid, these things don't really go together very well, because if he's such a genius to produce this marvelous work, how can he be a complete dithering idiot about what he believes? So I said, well, why don't I at least find out what do these people called Christians, what do they actually believe when they talk about God? Just as a way of taking Tolkien more seriously. And I recommend this. I think this is a way into looking at the question. Because if you go into it thinking, you know, this is all about me, it can put a kind of pressure, like I have to make a decision. And I think for me, it was helpful. I think in God's providence, this is how he drew me in to say, well, just go into looking into this so that you can better understand your favorite authors. Go into it open-mindedly, not dismissing what they believe, but genuinely trying to figure out, well, how would they present what they believed? Not what the critics would say they believe, but how would they present what they believed? And of course, since, you know, another one of these authors who was, you know, causing me some sort of difficulties was C.S. Lewis. Again, loved his work. Here he is, this Christian. And then reading what Lewis himself had written, you know, Mere Christianity, for instance, Miracles, books like that, and finding, you know, Lewis explaining himself what he believes and realizing, oh, you know, this is actually pretty sensible. So that, I think, would be what I would suggest. And now for Tolkien himself, you know, Tolkien doesn't, in his published writings, doesn't say a lot about his faith, because that wasn't the approach that he took. He believed in a more implicit literary approach. But he does, I mean, there are some bits in the letters where he talks a little bit about his faith, not as much as there should be, because the letters are a very partial, account. There's only 364 out of thousands and thousands that he is known to have written. And most of those selections are partial. Some of them are only a paragraph. And the compiler of the letters, Humphrey Carpenter, with the assistance of his son, Christopher Tolkien, but by and large, the selection was made by Humphrey Carpenter, who was himself an atheist. And I think that there's a lot that is undoubtedly left out. Some of the accounts by, you know, his friends, by his granddaughter, are that he was very open about, you know, saying, I'll pray for you, you know, things like that. We don't see that in the letters. So I think the letters can sometimes give an impression that Tolkien compartmentalized his faith, when the larger context, the little bits that we have, suggest that wasn't the case at all. So the letters have a few bits, but it's wise not to take that as being comprehensive, because they're not a collected or complete letters. They're very, very partial and selective. The other thing I think that's worth looking at is the epilogue to Tolkien's great essay on fairy stories, because there, in a pretty short span, he kind of gives a compressed account of the gospel, really, as the gospel as the great happy ending of creation, you know, the fairy story that actually happened. And I think that if you read that and think that here's a man who is integrated, he's able to bring together his imaginative and his rational faculties. He didn't have to put his reason to one side to be a believer. He was able to see how these things went together. And it's quite short, that section of On Fairy Stories, but it certainly affected me very deeply. And I think it's quite beautiful and moving. And it's worth reading, and I think kind of meditating on, because I think that gives us a pretty good glimpse of how Tolkien viewed his own faith. And it's, like I said, quite powerful.
So is that the kind of thing that you're going to be covering in this book that you're working on?
Yes. The book that I'm working on, working title is Tolkien's Christian Faith, What He Believed and Why It Matters. And so it's basically biographical. And it's going through, you know, his life with an attention to, you know, well, what did he believe? How was it that he became a Catholic? You know, because interestingly, he is technically a convert, because he was received into the church, you know, as a boy, but past the age of reason. So he was actually received into the Catholic Church as an adult, after his mother Mabel first, and then him a little bit later. And then just finding so much more, all the, you know, interviews and, you know, various bits and pieces that are scattered throughout the, you know, Tolkien research materials, bringing that together and really showing what was his faith, how was it formed, how did it influence his life, how did it influence his writing. And it'll be primarily biographical, because otherwise I will never finish. Another book will probably delve into the literary aspects. But my hope is that people, this book is going to be for every reader of Tolkien, whether they're an atheist or an agnostic or a Christian or a Protestant or a Catholic or whatever. Anybody who just wants to know what did Tolkien believe. Because I think that if we are to take him seriously and really engage properly with his work, we need to have a really thoroughly three-dimensional grasp of his faith, regardless of whether you share it, as I do, or you don't. You want to understand it. And I think right now there really aren't any fully well-rounded, really thoroughly researched accounts of his faith, which is what I'm trying to do. It's great fun.
Yeah. Well, going back to what you're saying about talking about how he came up with the languages and the whole history that you said, as you said, it wasn't a chore. It wasn't like, oh, I have to do this so I can write this book. He would have done it anyway. Talk to someone that feels like they're being drawn to doing something creative like that, or it hits me that was not practical. It was not practical for him to sit down and come up with these languages and come up with all this history. But he was drawn to it, and there was this joy in him in doing it. So talk to someone that feels like they're being drawn to something that might not be practical like that.
Oh, I love this question, because one of the things I do have taught before at HBU and now do teach it in the Word on Fire Institute is creative writing. And so this aspect of Tolkien's life is, I think, just so, so important. I think if anybody who's drawn to doing creative work, whether it's writing or art, and I can speak to writing, since that's my thing, you do have to just love it, and you do have to devote yourself to it. And it's going to take time. We see, we see the Lord of the Rings is this great, massive work. It's epic. It's phenomenal work. And we forget that it came at the peak of his creative powers after decades of writing. And now we've got the whole 12 volumes of the history of Middle Earth. We have all the drafts and all of the preceding, variations on the different stories of the legendarium. He didn't just sit down and say, yes, I think I'll tell the story about the ring and dash it off. It was a 10-year project, just writing it. But even those 10 years were rooted in decades of this labor of love, where he's telling these stories, he's working out the different stories, and he's also finding different ways, finding his own voice. And one of the most interesting things about his voice that I discovered in writing Tolkien's Modern Reading is that when he was a young man, writing the very first versions of what would be the story of the Fall of Gondolin, which we eventually do find in the Silmarillion as published, he's very deeply influenced by the prose style of an author called William Morris, who is super archaic. He's a 19th century fantasy writer who is just everything you can picture about fake medieval is William Morris. And it's got a certain charm, but it hasn't really aged all that well. It's not something that is particularly gripping. It's very mannered. It's very highly artificial. And Tolkien's initial writing, he says actually in some of his letters that he's deliberately writing these pieces modeled after Morris. So he gets the idea from Morris. His imagination is fired up by Morris. And so he takes it, he runs with it, and he even uses a lot of Morris's very archaizing style. And you see this very distinctively in the first versions of The Fall of Gondolin. But then he grows out of it. He continues to write. He continues to work. And gradually, by the time we get to The Lord of the Rings, he has shifted into a much different style where he does use the occasional archaic touch, but he doesn't do it like Morris is like archaic on full volume the whole time. He's turned up to 10 the whole time. It's one steady tone. Tolkien, as a mature adult writer, has learned to have a huge range of tones, from the very modern colloquial to the higher noble registers to, you know, the low comic, and with the archaisms brought in every now and then to heighten the effect. And I think sometimes people who don't like The Lord of the Rings will glom onto one of the, you know, bits of archaic phrasing and say, oh, see? But it's very silly, because those are it's not his tone the whole way. His tone is extremely flexible, which is extremely a very modern style, interestingly.
Yeah. Well, he uses different tones for all the different races. So you can see that the elves are long lived because of the language that they use.
But even then, we have the different levels, because we have the elves, you know, at the Council of Elrond, but then you've also got Legolas playfully sparring with Gimli. Mm-hmm. So he's got all these different registers. But this is something he learned. He doesn't have this flexibility when he starts writing. And I think that is a huge thing. We can say, look, everybody, if Tolkien can have this process of growth, so can you. He didn't hatch out of the egg writing The Lord of the Rings, you know, from the get-go. And I think that's a lesson that we really need to bring to creators, is to have this persistence and also this patience with themselves. The first thing you write is not going to be awesome. I mean, The Fall of Gondolin is, you know, we read it now, this first version, because Tolkien's great and we're interested in everything about Tolkien. But by itself, if that was the only thing he wrote, it would be forgotten, because it's, okay, it's a sort of interesting piece, but not that great, all things considered. Yeah. It's in the context of his later achievement that it's super interesting. So I think that's a lesson for creators, is like, have that perseverance and that aim to grow, and the knowledge that everybody has to grow. Nobody just starts from the get-go writing awesome things.
Well, even then, taking the lesson within The Lord of the Rings, that seeing that he had this worldview that we are part of a greater story, and, you know, just like Frodo, we have to go through so many struggles, so many stages in our journey, that in the creative process, it's the same way. You have to start, but then you have to struggle. You have to fall. You have to get up. You have to try again. It's the same process. And realizing that the journey that Frodo went on is the same journey that we all have to go on, especially for someone who's creative. They have to keep trying again.
Yes. And this is such, I mean, that's such an insightful point, because I think in my work with creative writers, one of the number one, possibly the number one stumbling block for them is that they give up because they get frustrated and they think, oh, this is just terrible. I have to tell them, look, you know, I'm sure there are some writers who don't go through this, but I've never met any of them. And certainly for me, it is a built-in part of the writing process, that there is going to be a part of this stage where I'm going to look at what I'm writing and think, this is terrible. This is just, this is rubbish. This is the worst thing I've ever written. No one will read it. If they read it, they'll hate it. It's just terrible. But see, I've now been writing for many years, and I know my own process. And I think, I'm extremely depressed about this book right now. But I always feel depressed at this stage. I just need to keep writing. I just need to get this draft finished. And then I can go back and I can start that process, that laborious process of getting it, you know, getting it better and better. And man, there are some times when it does feel like I'm on the trek to Mordor and I'd like to cast my manuscript into Mount Doom. But you have to go through it. And once you've gone through that a few times, you start to then be able to doubt your own doubts and say, I think this is terrible, but I always think that. I'm not going to trust my judgment. I'm just going to keep going. Or you start to be able to see, okay, I see some problems, and that's not the same thing as just my general feeling of this is terrible. These are actual problems with my story or with my research. I need to address those problems. Again, you only can get to that point through practice. But there's another aspect of your analogy that I think is really interesting, which is that as writers, we need a fellowship. You know, Frodo does not get all that way, by himself. Now, this is actually a really great analogy, because sure, he's the only one who carries the ring. Okay. And ultimately, all of us writers, we are the ones who have to put the words on the page. It is, in the end, what I have to do. But we need a fellowship. We need to be writing in a community. And that's something, again, that I try to bring into my teaching, into my work at the Word on Fire Institute, to create communities of writers that can be like the Inklings, that can give feedback, that can be an interested audience. I mean, just having somebody who is interested in seeing you finish it is a huge motivation. And then, of course, giving feedback. This is so important. And I think too many writers, in fact, probably most writers are suffering from trying to do it alone. And it's just, it's terrible to do it alone. You need to have other people who can be sharing and giving feedback and just giving encouragement and just honestly commiserating. Yeah, footnotes are a pain in the neck. Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that I have the same struggles doing, doing any sort of any videos. I have the same moments where I'm like, oh my goodness, this is crap. And I know that, you know, I've had the experience enough times, just like you have in writing, that if I push back that, oh, this is crap moment, and I get to the point where then I get enough of the video edited to be like, oh, wait a second, there might be actually something good in this, and get to the final one, be like, oh, that's pretty good. I'm glad I can push through.
Yeah, because I think there can be a kind of perfectionism that means that people never do anything, because they start and they see this is not how I want it to be, and then they just give up. They never get past that point, and so they never get the reward of seeing something that comes out in the end pretty decent.
Yeah, yeah. A saying that I have gone back to many times and tried to live by, and I've heard a number of different versions of this, but the way I always say it to myself is, the perfect is the enemy of the good.
Yes.
If you're trying to be perfect, then you're not going to put anything out, and you're not going to be good.
Yep. Yeah, I hear you, because that is something that I have to remind myself of as well. Another way of putting it is nothing is ever perfect. It's just finished.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep. Yep.
You know, I've got to submit my book to my editor at some point. And of course, you know, with Tolkien's Modern Reading, it was, that book took 10 years to write. And let's just say that it took considerably longer than I kept saying it was going to take, because I kept having to do more research and eventually it got to where I just needed to finish it, because I did get to a point where I thought, okay, I could still keep tinkering with it. Surely I could probably track down one more interesting fact somewhere or polish this thing. But I got to the point where I could say, honestly, this is as good as I can possibly make it. And not every book can even get to that stage. Sometimes books or articles are, well, I've done the best I could in the time I had allotted, and now it's due, and I send it to my editor. This book, I had the great blessing of being able to really get it to the point where I could say, this is as good as I could possibly get it. And even then, of course, there are things I found afterwards that I would, in the second printing, I've got a couple of corrections, such as life. But it has to go out, it had to go out, because if we're going to do this work, it's for the purpose of sharing it with readers.
Right.
And ultimately, one has to cultivate a kind of humility and say, it's not about me. It's, is this worth sharing? The work, is the work worth sharing? If it's not, why am I doing it? But if it is, it's not about me. Mm-hmm. And I need to get it out there for the readers. And they may like it, they may not, they may find it useful, they may not. You hope and pray it's helpful. You do what you can to help people connect with it. And then you get on with the next thing that you're working on.
Yeah. Well, the last question that I always ask a guest is, other than literature, writing, and Tolkien, what are one or two things that you really nerd out about?
hmm. By covering Tolkien and literature as already taken into account, you have covered a great deal of my nerddom. I am quite nerdy about tea. I'm quite a tea snob. I have highly developed views about how it is that one should make tea.
So how do you prepare your tea?
You must have good tea, which I typically bring back tea from England because I like Twinings every day. You can't buy it in the States, mm-hmm. but here Twinings English Breakfast is okay, or Yorkshire Gold or PG Tips. Good tea, boiling water. Has to be boiling water. The water should be still boiling as it hits the tea in your cup. Okay. None of this, like, just hot water. Like, having just merely hot water onto tea makes this insipid beverage. And then you have to use milk, whole milk, not skim or 2% or anything nasty like that. Whole milk, yeah. And ideally, you put the milk in first.
Okay. Yeah. That was going to be my question, because I've heard debates, you know, milk before or after.
Oh, it's a heated debate amongst tea nerds. Yes. But I hold with the pre-lactarian position. where you put the milk in first. Now, I grant the arguments of the post-lactarians, but they're wrong. Milk first, tea, water on top of that, and then we're good. Yeah.
I will try to hold to that gospel from now on. Well, Holly, thank you so much for joining me today. If someone goes to hollyordway.com, what will they find there?
Well, they'll find really information about all of my books and links to my work at the Word on Fire Institute. And it has my speaking schedule, which is not terribly up to date, but it has a contact page. So if, for instance, folks wanted to have me come and speak to them, they can get in touch with me. But a lot about my books and list of my articles and various things that they can read.
Okay, great. Well, I want to thank you again for joining me, and thank you for joining us on this episode of Nerding Out with That Nerdy Catholic. I want to remind you that Nerding Out is brought to you by Nerdy Catholic Teas, the other arm of the little Nerdy Catholic kingdom we have here. We just put out a redesign, and I'm going to put a little graphic of it right here. I haven't gotten my own yet, but an updated design of the Further Up and Further In t-shirt, which is a mashup between Doctor Who and the Last Battle of C.S. Lewis. You see the TARDIS with the door open and the mountains going through, just like the door in the Last Battle. So you can head over to Nerdy Catholic Tees to get that, as well as a number of other designs. If you use the coupon code ThatNerdyCatholic, you will get 10% off of your order. And we will see you again next week. God bless.
System shut down.